Welcome to the MedEl podcast series on Closest to Natural Hearing. I'm Markus Schmidt, Chief Marketing Officer at MedEl, and today in episode 7, we're talking about something that has changed the perception of cochlear implantation, and that is preserving natural hearing and the delicate inner ear structures. Joining me today are Professor Stefan Weder. He is team leader, auditory pathway, and co-head of the Otology and Hearing Implant Center at the Department of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery at the Bern University Hospital in Switzerland. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you so much for having me.
And with me also today is Ilona Anderson. She is Corporate Director of Clinical Research at MedEl, and she has a long history with hearing preservation studies. Ilona, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Markus, and hi, Stefan. Nice to be with you both.
And together, we'll explore how flexible electrode arrays and advanced surgical tools like Otoplan, Otodrive are helping surgeons protecting delicate structures in the cochlea and support residual hearing. And we'll also look at the latest clinical data on hearing preservation, including FDA-approved hearing preservation, and discuss how these innovations are improving quality of life for CI users, and CI stands for cochlear implant. So if you're curious about how technology and surgery come together to support natural hearing, this episode is for you. So let's start with the big picture. Stefan, what exactly do we mean by hearing preservation in the context of cochlear implantation?
Yeah, so I think we should distinguish between functional hearing preservation and structural hearing preservation. So functional hearing preservation usually refers to the residual acoustic hearing of a patient. So nowadays, most cochlear implant patients or candidates have substantial residual hearing, mostly in the lower frequency region. And our aim is really to preserve these acoustic hearing despite the electrode implantation inside the inner ear. Because many studies have shown so far that these patients where we are successful in preserving the inner ear function, they actually perform better in everyday listening situations. And then the second term is a bit more broadly taken, so the structural hearing preservation. So here it really relates that we want to preserve the delicate structures of the inner ear. So we want to respect the very integrity of the cochlea, because we know that if the implant is placed, if we can preserve as many functioning cells as possible, the implant itself will have more cells to stimulate. So this will give us an advantage.
Okay, thank you. This whole topic of hearing preservation started around 25 years ago. And up to about, 10, 20 years ago, people didn't ask about hearing preservation. So why is hearing and structure preservation such a critical goal in cochlear implantation? Ilona.
Okay, I don't think it's critical now more than what it was before. Markus, you and I, we worked on proving hearing preservation for electric stimulation starting nearly 25 years ago. Maybe that's why you say I've got a long history in this. And I think it really stemmed when Professor von Ilberg published the very first EAS case in 1999. And I think MedEl took that up as a really important thing because, I mean, as Stefan said, we respect the anatomy. And that's really important. And I think over the years, with more and more success, it's become a critical goal now for today. And I think it is because more and more people have that low frequency hearing loss. They don't want to lose it, not at all. And I think that's where surgeons and also audiologists with their fitting really want to respect that the person maintains their hearing. And I think more and more people believe that they can preserve hearing. I think that's also something. In any research, you always have early adopters, some people who are more cautious. And I think now most people are not cautious anymore. They really believe. And I think it comes to the critical goal of what we do that's best for our patients.
And we have come a long way. I mean, as you said, I remember when Professor von Ilberg first you know, mm-hmm. presented his results, the majority of people were not believing that you would open the cochlea, you introduce a foreign body in the cochlea, and you still preserve hearing.
Exactly.
So, Stefan, you mentioned the delicate structures. What are the anatomical structures that we aim to preserve? And, you know, how does that impact long-term hearing outcomes?
Yeah, sure. Maybe I can just add a response to the last question as well. So I think patient cords have changed a little bit because nowadays we concentrate more on the speech understanding. And some people have like very low speech understanding despite they have residual hearing. So I think the patient cord has changed a little bit. And this is also probably that the focus on preserving this residual hearing has become more of an interest. Because in early days, we looked more on the pure tone audiogram when indicating a CI. And nowadays, we look more on the speech perception with hearing aid. So we see now more patients who still have residual hearing, but don't have enough speech understanding with a hearing aid alone. To your next question, that's a very important point. So we have the advantage that we have already naturally a space where we can put the implant. So the inner ear consists of three fluid-filled chambers, and they're separated by very delicate membranes. So we have a lower chamber, which is the scala tympani. So it starts at the round window, and it goes up to the helicotrema. Then we have the middle chamber, which also hosts the sensorineural organ, the corti organ. And then we have an upper chamber, the scala vestibuli, which starts at the helicotrema and goes to the oval window. And because we have these natural chambers, they can, as I said, host an electrode implant without disturbing actually the anatomy and the cells of the inner ear. And this is a huge advantage of the inner ear. So we are able to place this implant electrode. However, we still have to be aware we put a foreign body inside. So we should really take care during the surgery that, for example, we don't have any bleeding inside the inner ear, because we know that if we have bleeding or inflammation or an immune response from the patient's body, this can lead to fibrosis and decrease of these natural residual function.
Okay, so there's two things that we don't want to do: mechanical damage, and we also want to avoid this foreign body reaction, these inflammations.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. So metal kind of praises itself for having atraumatic electrodes. How do metal's electrodes support hearing preservation?
Well, Marcus, I'll take us back in time. So when we were first looking at hearing preservation, we had the medium electrode, okay, which was stiffer. And I think that's how we started our approval. But while we were in that pre-market study, Medel produced a flex electrode. And we actually started another pre-market study with the flex electrode. And our notified body said, we're not using the M electrode because it's the flex electrode that is going to rule the world. So we didn't get approved for the M electrode, but we did for the flex. And I think the thing is, it's because it's this beautiful array that goes really far into the cochlea, just like you were saying earlier there, Stefan. And I think it gives us this sense that we can go further in without really damaging structure. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. And I think also we reflect that every cochlea is a different size. So it's not like we just have a one electrode fits all. And that's why we have a range of flex electrodes so that we can look at the cochlea, because we want to personalize everything to that patient. And then we can choose the correct electrode to fit into that cochlea. So if you have really significant low-frequency residual hearing, you might want to use a shorter electrode so that you don't go anywhere near that lower frequency because there's a significant amount. But more and more people are now using slightly longer electrodes with great surgical technique for hearing preservation and are still getting hearing preservation results. And I think a surgeon might choose the difference between those electrodes based on how much residual hearing there is. But I think the electrode itself is really what helps with that hearing preservation. And of course, there are lots of things that have to be done. It's multifactorial. But I think the electrode is a key component in that hearing preservation. And that's a flex electrode.
Okay. You mentioned early studies. What's the state of the art in, you know, recent studies or clinical data that show the effectiveness on MedEl's approach on hearing and structure preservation?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of studies going on, and we can see when we accumulate those. So these are specific studies when we do hearing preservation surgery. Okay, so that's the important part in this point. And with that, we see that people who have a Flex 24 electrode, there's about above 90% hearing preservation. If we look at users who have the Flex 28, we are still seeing at about 87% of articles show that people have 87% chance of having residual hearing. And even with the Flex Soft, which is slightly longer, we see that in about 88% of people have some kind of residual hearing. So that says a lot already with good surgery and choosing the correct electrode, and we see good results there. The other side of it is not really the electrode per se, but what the electrode does in the cochlea. And here you have two different kinds of electrodes. You have lateral wall electrodes and preformed electrodes. And what we did is we looked at, we did a scientific review across from August 2014 to December 2023 using a scoping review analysis. And out of this, we found 66 publications talking about what these electrodes can do. And we found that from this 66 publications, we got nearly 5,000 implantations that we could look at, of which 1,700 were lateral wall arrays and 2,700 were preformed arrays. And we had to look there for scalar deviation. And we could see that from of these arrays that there was more scalar deviation in preformed electrode arrays, 25%, compared to only 8.1% in lateral wall electrodes. And I think that's really important because MedEl only has lateral wall electrodes. And I think that goes back to the previous question you had for me, Marcus, is that's why we have flexible electrodes, so that we stay exactly where we should be in the cochlea.
So it's two things then, right? It's lateral wall electrodes and it's soft electrodes. So yeah. That means that lateral wall electrode does not equal lateral wall electrodes.
We even see with the other companies that their lateral wall electrodes are better than their preformed, but not as good as ours.
I mentioned in the introduction, the FDA recently approved MedEl CIs for hearing preservation. What does that mean? Can you give us some insight to that, Alona?
Yeah. So when you get an approval for something, you have to put in a claim. And a claim is not something you suck out of your thumb. It's absolutely evidence-based. And I always say, look on any manufacturing thing, there's always an asterisk. And that asterisk should say where it's come from. And that should be a publication or a major study. And sometimes they have this nice claim and you read there and it says, this isn't a claim at all. So I think it's important that if we have a claim, we have to have really good evidence-based research to get that claim. And so we wanted to get this claim with the FDA that all of our electrodes, independent of the surgery technique, can preserve some residual hearing. But to do this, we had to do a study. And we couldn't do a biased study looking only at people who have residual hearing. We were asked to look at all comers. So those who had very little residual hearing, those people who had no residual hearing, they wanted to start with that as a baseline to see how we could show residual hearing. So we actually at MedEl have a registry running in Germany, and that's everyone in. So what we look is we looked at that data and we did a number of extractions out of that data to see who had residual hearing. It's a registry, so you know it's not like a study. Your data isn't exactly as rigorous, that we looked at people who had preoperative data and postoperative data over time, and we could then see what was happening with the surgery. So do they preserve hearing or not? We looked at it from two perspectives, and that goes back to you, Stefan, earlier. We looked at the fact that there's functional hearing and then that there is residual hearing. So one of them was a Vienna consensus formula, and the other one is a formula recognized by the AAO. And I always say, when we have a group of people, and I know, Stefan, you said that the cohort has changed, but it was really interesting in this registry that we started with something like 2,000 implant surgeries. And then as you go down and see really who has some degree of residual hearing, also, if you're in a group and you all have a hearing loss, the large majority of you will be deaf. And of the rest, we have a little corner of residual hearing. And I always try and explain these results based on that, because people might say, well, your numbers are low, but they are from a bigger picture. That's how many we have. And so from that, we were able to extract data on a number of our electrodes. And from that, we saw that 57% of all of the electrodes together have a limited PTA shift, so less than 30 dBs across all the electrode arrays. I mean, that's outstanding, because it's not necessarily that we don't know who the surgeons were. We do not know what type of surgery they did. Did they even think of hearing preservation? So this is really an all-in. So an all-in with 57% is outstanding. Of course, we see it per electrode. We have a 75% with the Flex 24 having hearing preservation, 62% with the Flex 28, and of course with the Flex Soft, it is only 44%. But I think that really goes further in, and most people would do that with people who are deaf or have very limited hearing preservation. Also from this, we saw that 90% of our Flex 24 recipients had good functional hearing, so could either use the acoustic stimulation either with an electric acoustic stimulation processor or using their natural hearing. And I think the other thing is that we found within this group that 97% had success into the scalar tympani, which I think is really astounding for what we have. With that data, the FDA said you can use these claims because they are evidence-based from an all-in process. And I'm not sure who can do that. I think it's absolutely outstanding what we can say.
And it's only MED-EL that got that approval from the FDA.
Correct. Only MED-EL. And I think what it also shows to the surgeons is that if I come in and I have some residual hearing, I don't want to lose it. But by saying with any electrode we can have a good chance of preserving hearing, you can say, let's go now. You don't have to wait, say if you've got a progressive hearing loss, till you're deaf. So you don't lose any of that opportunity. And also, we know that having good residual hearing in the low frequencies does give more benefit to those people. So I think in the end, yeah, we're showing great hearing preservation results, but why did we do it? To make it good for the patient to get the best they can.
Okay,
thank you. So let me sort this out. From the study that you mentioned before that, where surgeons tried to preserve hearing in a study environment, we are around, 88-90% preservation. But even if we count, all the preservation as it comes in from many surgeons, many didn't even try to preserve hearing. Any patients, how they come in, real world, everything comes in. Even there, there's the 57% preservation.
Correct.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That is not bad.
That's not bad at all. Okay, well, that's good. Let's shift to the surgical side. Stefan, what are the key challenges for you as a surgeon in achieving, precision during cochlear implant surgery and also to approach hearing and structural preservation?
Yeah, sure. I think the key challenge is really the electrode handling throughout the entire procedure. So we can divide it in two parts. So there's really the insertion process, and there is also the handling of the electrode after full insertion. So the surgeon has to stabilize it in the mastoid cavity. So to the first point, electrode insertion, I think here many studies have been done also, as Ilona just mentioned. And the problem of the human hand is just, and we know this from our own measurements, that the human hand is not capable of advancing an electrode steadily and slowly. So it's more a stop and go movement. And we know from our pressure and force measurements that this mini movement can still have a huge impact on the inner ear. And then there is, of course, tremor, as we all know. So we have these movements, these inattentional movements going into the cochlea. So this is really the insertion phase, which is critical. But what also a lot of surgeons forget is the handling of the electrode after full insertion. So we also know from our measurements that it really depends how the surgeon handles the electrode lead in the mastoid cavity, because this can lead to huge force and pressure changes. And we know that when we look at the whole implantation process, up to 40% of the energy load, which is going into the cochlea, stems from this second part. And this is also important if we talk today about auto-arm auto-drive. So I believe auto-arm auto-drive can really make a difference, but we should not forget the insertion is not over when the electrode is fully inserted. So the surgeon still has to handle these critical points to have an optimal result.
Okay. And just for our listeners, I mean, I've seen many, many surgeons, and I'm always amazed how steady the hands of the surgeons are. But you still say that the tremor here should be improved or can be improved.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. So we hosted a conference last year, and there we have a temple bone model. So it's a 3D print of a human temple bone, and we have a transparent cochlea there. And it's a multi-sensor tool. So we can measure force, pressure. We can also measure the forceps handling of the surgeon. We can measure the times that he is proceeding. We can also see or automatically track the electrode lead going into the cochlea. And at this conference last year, we did a competition, and there were 30 surgeons from all over the world. And these were all top surgeons, not beginners. So they had at least 200 surgeries plus. And we just saw huge differences of force and pressure profiles when recording the data. So it really depends how the surgery is done, and it really matters what we are doing in the surgical rooms.
So yeah, let's talk about these precision tools that can improve this. I mean, on the one hand, there is AutoPlan, which is a visualization and planning tool. On the other hand, there's AutoDrive and AutoArm, which are used for a motorized and robotic insertion of the cochlear implant electrode in the cochlea. So let's start with AutoPlan. What can AutoPlan do for you as a surgeon?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Now, I think it has become very clear that the anatomy of the human cochlea varies very much individually. And this point has been forgotten sometimes in the past. And nowadays, we often do imaging studies before surgery, and we can use these studies to measure the cochlea. For example, the cochlear duct length, which is basically just how long is the individual cochlea of this patient. And from our old cohort, we know that the difference between the longest cochlea of our cohort and the shortest, there is a difference of more than 1 centimeter.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And if you put this now into the clinic, so it probably matters, because we should select the electrode carrier, as Ilona also said earlier, appropriately. And the problem is, if you have a very short cochlea and we put in a very long electrode carrier, it might endanger the hearing structural preservation. Whereas if we have a very long cochlea and we take only a standard length of 24 millimeters, we might not cover the neural cells that we want to cover. So here, I think AutoPlan can really help us to see these differences before surgery and select the electrode lead appropriately.
Okay, so can you walk us through how AutoPlan works in practice?
Yeah, I think so. With the current version, it can now really be rapidly integrated in the clinical workflow. So in all CI candidates, we do some kind of imaging studies. In kids, we usually do an MR scan. And in adults, we usually do an MR scan together with a photon counting CT. So photon counting CT is a technology which has low radiation. So it's good for the patient, but it has a very high resolution. And this is good for AutoPlan because AutoPlan, the newest version, it can automatically detect the anatomy of an individual patient. So in our case, we did these imaging studies, which we would anyway do. And these imaging studies can then be loaded into AutoPlan. And our engineering team, for all patients who receive a medial implant, they will measure the cochlear anatomy. And then we have a so-called hearing implant board. And there we discuss together which electrode care is the most suitable for the patient.
Okay. So you basically you import that into AutoPlan, the imaging, and then it gives you like a 3D
yes.
visualization.
Exactly. It automatically detects the cochlea. And from there on, it puts it also in a modeling calculation, and then it really calculates how long is the cochlea in this patient, how much place do we have in the scala tympani, do we have enough space at the top, which electrode is best, so you can also display the electrode care in these calculations of AutoPlan. So you actually see how deep, for example, a Flex 28 will go inside the cochlea. You can also see the frequency range. So it gives you a lot of information which can be very helpful understanding the individual planning of this patient.
So it's not only selecting an electrode, but it's also, I mean, for you as a surgeon, I mean, the cochlea is kind of a black box, right? I mean, you open the middle ear, but you never have a look into the cochlea, actually. So does it help you to kind of see an image of the cochlea before surgery?
I think it just raises an awareness that not every cochlea is the same. So there, as I said, there are huge differences. And I mean, in the end, with the cochlear implant, we want to cover the spiral ganglion. And of course, we have to discuss with the patient what that means. And really, depending on the size, I think this can matter of meaning like which structures are we covering by the electrode and which are we not covering.
Okay, so this was AutoPlan, a planning tool and a visualization tool. Now, on the other hand, we have AutoDrive and AutoArm motorized robotic tools. How do they work and you know, what does that give to you?
Yeah, so now we change into the surgical rooms. So these instruments usually come together. So the AutoArm is more the holding mechanism. So we have the patient lying on the operating table. So usually we operate in full narcosis. And then on the other side of the operated side, we mount the AutoArm, and then the AutoArm goes around the head of the patient. And then before draping the patient, we actually check that we have all degrees of freedom so that we really can move afterwards. So at the end of the AutoArm, we mount the AutoDrive, which is basically just a motorized forceps. And at the back of AutoDrive, we have different screws. So we can really fine tune the position of the instrument so that we can really align it well with the basal turn of the cochlea. So before draping, we just check that everything is going well, and that we have all degrees of freedom that we want. Then we drape it, we put it aside, we do the cochlear implantation as usual until we reach the round window. And then we take the AutoDrive system again and we place it in such a way that we will have a good alignment with the basal turn. Then we can do fine adjustments as needed, as I said, with these screws. We can put the electrode carrier inside the forceps. And then we have a pedal. and a software interface on a computer where we can say, I want to go this speed. So usually at our center, we take the lowest speed, which is 0.1 millimeters per second. And then usually we first advance it with the screws. And as soon as the electrocarrier has reached a round window and is ready to be inserted into the inner ear, we take now the pedals. And we just push the pedal and introduce the electrode very, very gently and slowly inside the cochlea. Another advantage of the auto drive system is with the interface, we actually know how deep we have already gone inside the cochlea. And for me as a surgeon, this is also a very important information because it gives you a more understanding, especially if you do at the same time some type of electrophysiological measurements such as electrocochleography, so you really know where these measurements come from.
One question. I mean, first, it is 0.1 millimeters per second. That means that in 10 seconds, it's 1 millimeter. So this is extremely slow. So I think that's quite amazing. But now you're an experienced surgeon. You really have a lot of surgical skills. Does that really enhance your surgical position? I mean, what is your personal feedback working with auto drive?
So yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting question. So again, we looked at this in multiple ways. So we started with our research group and we first took our model that I was talking about before. So this is these multi-sensor measurements. And we had three experienced surgeons and they performed 10 implantations each, first manually. So as they were used, they could use all instruments which were usually used in the operating theater. And then in the next step, they employed the auto drive system. And then we ran the statistics on these multiple measurements. So especially force and force measurements, pressure peaks, and so on. And we just saw a statistical significance between the two techniques, no matter who the surgeon was. So we can really see that when we use such a motorized tool, there are fewer pressure peaks, fewer force variation. So the whole process seems to be much gentler. And then we obviously went into the operating room. So we took now these findings. And I think now for 1.5 years, we have used AutoDrive so far. And we have implanted, I believe, more than 50 patients using the AutoDrive system. And we have now compared our figures. So we did a match group. So we had conventional cases and we have AutoDrive cases. And they were matched according to electrode length, residual hearing, gender, age at implantation. And what we found when taking 27 patients in each group, we found that there was a tendency in patients with good residual hearing before surgery with the AutoDrive system, they seemed to preserve more of the acoustic hearing. We also looked at the speech understanding scores. As it seems by now, the early numbers, so looking at 3 and 6 months postoperative, the two groups, so conventional and AutoDrive, they were very similar. We have now newer figures, and it seems that the AutoDrive might excel the conventional cases, but we still have to add some more cases just to have a more robust statistics.
Okay, so it does make a difference. Also, not only for you as a surgeon, but also for the CI user.
I mean, that's the aim. I mean, we don't have to please only the surgeon. We have to have a good result for the patient. I think that's the main goal, yeah.
Okay. Now, one more question. You know, you said that you have to mount this and then it's a very slow insertion of the CI electrode. Does that expand the time of surgery a lot or what is...
Yeah. So I think there is a learning curve included, especially because the flex electrode are so flexible. So you have to get used to all the screws, how they work, to the alignment, and also how the electrode lead actually enters the inner ear. But there are some tips and tricks, and I think if you can master them nowadays, it adds some time in the preparation of the patient. So when draping, but this is not a lot, maybe 2-3 minutes. And then obviously the insertion process takes a bit longer just because we are also slower. So, I mean, if you do like a usual insertion, it takes 1.5 minutes. And now using this lowest speed, we have at least 5-6 minutes. Maybe you have to do some adjustment at the beginning. So I think in total, that's roughly 10 minutes.
Okay. But it's not massively.
No. And I really think that the system can be well integrated. So it's not something completely new. I mean, there are a few new aspects, but in general, the search sheet stays the same. Only like the insertion process itself, it's different.
Now, do you use AutoDrive regularly, or are there cases where you say, okay, I'm not going to use that. I'm going to do it manually?
Yeah, I mean, usually we actually nearly always use AutoDrive. I mean, there are a few cases, especially in kits, we have to see what's trouble. What we don't want is that, like in kits, that the surgery is prolonged unnecessarily. And obviously, if you have like malformation cases and so on, we usually do it by hand. I mean, you can discuss in patients which have no residual hearing at all, if it makes sense. But then again, we talked about structural hearing preservation, which might also make sense. So I think if now centers produce more and more numbers, if they have more experience with the system, we really have to check larger data sets and see how the statistics go. And then if we see an advantage also in patients which have no residual hearing, there might be really a place for AutoDrive in nearly the majority of cases, I guess. Yeah.
And what do your patients say when you counsel them and you tell them that, you know, that there will be a motorized robotic insertion of the electrode? Do they accept that?
Yeah, I mean, we don't go too much into the details because the problem is a little bit that there is so much information for the patients. And in the end, I think what really matters for the patient is, A, does the implant work? Does he or she has a normal life? Does he achieve a good quality of life? I think these are the aspects which really matter and not like technical aspects of the surgery. But then again, we just say that it is a possibility at the moment. We don't have enough experience to like counsel them. Like we certainly need more experience, but basically we have enough experience to say like, the clinical workflow is going perfectly well. And so I think for the surgeon, there is no risk or anything associated with the use, as we can say by so far. So it's more like in the end, what we want to achieve for the patient is the best hearing and the best residual hearing, no matter what it takes. And we shouldn't concentrate on technical aspects. I don't also go too much into the details regarding the implant, like what is the coding strategy? It's not of any use. We really have to talk, what's the difference in the daily life of a patient? That's my opinion.
Okay. Now I see kind of three parts from what we've discussed. On the one hand, we have electrode design. We have these, you know, surgical tools like AutoDrive. But then there's also the surgical skills, of course. How do these, you know, things complement each other in achieving hearing preservation?
Yeah, I think it's just a combination. As Ilona said, everything has to fit. So, I mean, the electrode carry is very, very important as well. And I mean, there are studies about drug-eluting electrodes and so forth. So, as I said, there is a risk of fibrosis. And so the electrode has to be perfect. And at the same time, we have to optimize the surgical technique and we have to teach the surgeons how they should do it and so on. So I think it's just a combination of all these aspects if we want to achieve good results.
Okay. Now, Ilona, you've shown impressive hearing preservation results. So if surgeons, you know, attempt hearing preservation, we are in the 80-90% region. We are not at 100% preservation. What, I mean, of course, there's a number of aspects. And Stefan, you mentioned that, you know, it's the insertion, but it's also, you know, the part after the insertion. So what is needed so that we can get closer to the 100%?
Okay, I think the short answer is do hearing preservation on every single patient you have. Not just standard surgery, I think really a good hearing preservation surgery. I think that's important for functional hearing preservation. And like Stefan's also talked about, is about structural preservation. And I think if we do that, I think we take ourselves a long way. Because, you know, like with our claims study, that was all in. We didn't know what the surgeons do. But imagine if every single surgeon did hearing preservation, how those numbers would go up. But I think it's also, like you said, it's a combination of everything. But I think respecting the patient and doing hearing preservation on every single patient, I think will bring things up to nearly 100%.
Stefan, what is your perception on that? Well, what is needed so that we can approach the 100%?
Yeah, so I think there is still a way to go to the 100%. I see these numbers a little bit more critical. The problem is also, you nailed it to the point, I think, in the beginning, Marcus, when you said we see it a little bit like a black box. That's actually true. So the problem is really like, what we have at the moment is we have hearing tests, we have speech tests before surgery, we have imaging studies, maybe we have electrophysiological measurements. But in the end, patients must have different diseases. And what we can just measure is the output. So I think in the future, like now that we see that genetics are playing a more important role, electrophysiological recordings are playing a more important role, I think we are starting to uncover the problems of every single patient, or start to understand the individual problem, because we just group huge numbers of patients together and say he has residual hearing, he has not, she has not, and so on. But in the end, probably they have different diseases. Some have hair cell disease, others have like problems connecting to the spiral ganglion and so on. And these patients probably behave differently also to the electrocardiogram and so on. So I think the problem is larger than we think. And we just have to take all these puzzle parts together to get a bit of a better picture. But I think it's a very interesting journey. And I've already learned myself a lot during the last years. And I think we just have to work on every bit. And then probably we might be able to counsel patients more precisely, I guess.
Are there any other innovations on the horizon that could take hearing preservation and precision even further?
Yeah, from my side, Marcus, I've also looked over the last 25 years of being involved in hearing preservation, and we've got so much further to go. There's so much exciting things. I think one of the exciting things, as you talked, Stefan, is genetics. I'm really, really interested in that and how we can use that to tailor what we do in surgery. I also think drugs are important. I know there's a lot of research going on about how we can use drugs for not only hearing preservation, but also in the future, maybe reducing it or stopping it or whatever. But closer to us would be a drug-eluting electrode, which we are already studying in our pivotal study here at MedEl. So I think this is our near future, and I think there's going to be a lot of future things as well. So I think that's really exciting from my side.
Stefan, anything from your side?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I agree with Ilona. These are very key aspects that we have to understand. I absolutely agree. Just one more point from my side. You said which part is most critical for hearing preservation, and I said, like, let's bring them together. But I think we should even link them closer together. So, for example, we do a lot of electrophysiology. And what is very important when we now talk about autodrive, I said, we now know how far we are inside the cochlea. This gives us huge information about what we should expect from the electrophysiological response. And I think, like, one of the next key aspects is also linking these electrophysiological measurements together with the autoarm, autodrive, or any motorized insertion, the forceps, because you could even do it objectively and say, okay, let's stop if this signal deteriorates and so on. So there is still a huge potential in interpreting all these signals correctly.
So what we've learned today is we've come a long way, and there is still ways to go, especially in the electrophysiological, genetic, pharmacological domain. So it will be still very fascinating what we will see in the future. So, Stefan, Ilona, thank you for sharing your expertise. Thank you for being with us. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting us. Thank you, Marcus. Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you so much.